Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. More at alyeskapipeline.com.
Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kim Sherry. Did you know that 55% of American households engage in gardening? And the recent pandemic created 18.3 million new gardeners. Our great state of Alaska encompasses 8 hardiness zones, and Anchorage is ranked 9th in the U.S. for cities with the greatest number of community garden spaces. Today, we are speaking with two guests who are going to get us excited about the upcoming Alaska summer growing season. Blake Sauer is the Community Garden Programmer for the Municipality of Anchorage Community Garden Program, and Mark Wolbers is the President of the Alaska Pioneer Fruit Growers Association. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here. Blake, can you share a brief history of the community gardens in Anchorage?
Absolutely. The community gardens in Anchorage, the first one was put up in 1974. That's our C Street Community Garden. So that one essentially is our largest to this date. And the garden's initiated as a means of there was a reasonable demand for people that had a desire to garden, but maybe they were renters or just didn't have a yard otherwise that was sufficient enough to do the process. And since 1974, we've only expanded. We now have 5 municipally managed community gardens, including the aforementioned C Street. We have McPhee Community Garden. We have the Fairview Lions Community Garden, as well as the Chanchnu Muldoon Community Garden and the Bregaw Community Garden.
Wow, sounds like we're growing at a pretty good pace. So, Blake, are you a gardener yourself?
I'm a beginner, oddly enough. A lot of my position kind of pertains to more the administrative and like landscaping of it, because I do a lot of management around the plots, whereas the gardeners kind of do the gardening within the plots. So I am building that information and knowledge for sure, much of it directly coming from the gardeners. But at the moment, I'm still a bit of a beginner in that category.
So I am not a beginner gardener, but sometimes I act like a beginner gardener. I love gardening, but I just don't think I'm very good at it at times because I'm also a lazy gardener. What brought you to the position of community garden programmer?
Yeah, it's I've kind of had a lifelong passion for Parks and Rec. My first job was in Parks and Rec back in my hometown in Michigan. And that's essentially what brought me up here is that I was seeking better opportunities in Parks and Rec. And so I ended up getting into the Muni a little over 2 years ago. And since then, I've ascended to the role of community garden programmer, where that's obviously my main duty in the summertime is managing our 5 community gardens. But I also do things like ski lessons, skating events and programs in the winter, and archery outreach, which is actually coming up soon. All kinds of good stuff.
That's fun. Yeah, because, you know, the gardening part of it only has a certain amount of time you could be working on that. And then you've got the winter, which is much longer, right?
Oh, yeah. And that's something that from my previous history in Parks and Rec is completely different here. If anything, we ramp up in the winter. I mean, we do not stop recreating in the winter in Alaska, which is really awesome and kind of inspiring to see.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned that we started with 1 and we're up to 5 now. How have they evolved? How have the gardens evolved over time, or the spaces that you're using?
Yeah, each garden is very unique, both for the neighborhoods that they're in and those that kind of champion the process of planning them out. So one example that I would bring up is our newest one, Chanchnu Community Garden, which was put up in 2021. That one has a very unique system in that it also has a food forest, and it has a compost bin set up. And a lot of this was championed by Christy Wood, who's a community individual who just has been so helpful with that garden and other gardens. So it's just this really impressive system that kind of, depending on the neighborhood, the garden kind of molds to its community and what they need.
Can you tell us what a food forest is? Because I've never heard that term before.
Yeah, a food forest is essentially a collection of plants that would exist together naturally in an ecosystem. And most of them are fruit-bearing. The idea is that the food forest at Changshnu, for example, stays unlocked. So people are able to free forage there for whatever they may find on the fruiting trees and bushes in that area. But yeah, generally speaking, it's a community-focused space that we like to welcome others into so that they can try out the harvest from those fruit-bearing trees and bushes.
So the garden is open and members of the community that maybe that don't have plots are allowed to come in and kind of check it out?
Yeah. Well, at least the food forest is open, okay. Right? So at the Changshnu, there are locks on the garden, which the gardeners have access to through combination. But the food forest, which is attached on the left, we don't put locks on those.
Okay. And how do community members, how are they told of this? Like, is it kind of announced throughout the neighborhoods that, hey, come check out the food forest?
It's something that we really probably should put a little more effort into getting the word out, because it does seem, I'm always so surprised when people don't know about our Changshnu food forest there. But yeah, it's probably something we could work on getting the word out a little bit more. We do have certain events that take place at the park that bring a little bit more awareness to it, like the bike rodeo, which is coming up soon, takes place over there. And we have certain garden cleanup parties that we do invite the public to as well. With that being said, I would love to see the awareness be even higher for that food forest.
Yeah, absolutely, because that sounds really cool. And I've never even heard of it. I want to go check it out.
Yeah, it's a great space. It's open right now. It's like I said, there's still a little bit of snow on the ground over there, but it's still an awesome space.
So what are the different areas of town that each garden is located in?
Yeah, we definitely focus on the Northeast region, because what we found with different census data is that the renter percentage is just kind of really high in the Northeast region. For example, in the area surrounding the Fairview Lions Community Garden, the renter percentage is, I believe, 70, if I'm not mistaken. But in the Northeast as a whole, it's somewhere around 50, I believe. So we're just trying to support those people that kind of don't have yards and really need the service more than other spaces.
Sure. And are there plans to add any more community gardens? Are you seeing a need for it in other areas of town?
Yes, actually. The Willowa Park is going to be our next site for a community garden. My understanding is they're going to be building that this year, and we're hoping to open it next year for actual plot holders. So that is our next one. And that was something that was championed by one of the community councils. Let me make sure I have the right one here. The Russian Jack Community Council championed that and secured a $150,000 legislative grant in order to make that happen.
That's amazing. I love how we're just adding and adding. How would someone apply for a community garden plot? Are they all already taken, or are there any available? Because it seems like it's a pretty popular program.
It is very popular, and there's a couple ways to go about it. I think the biggest thing that people kind of might not be aware of is how early we start. So we start for new gardeners. We use a community garden lottery process. So essentially, they're able to apply for the community garden lottery in January and February. And then we cut those applications off at the end of February, and we basically announce the winners at the end of the renewal season. So the people who are returning do have the opportunity to renew, and then whatever plots are left over after the renewal process, we then offer those up to lottery winners.
Is there a waiting list right now?
There is a bit of a waiting list. We do traditionally have more applicants for the lottery than open plots. So in that way, it is definitely very popular. But sometimes we don't hear back when we call, which is always very surprising. And so we got to move on to the next person on the list.
So when someone has a plot and they reapply every year, do they get that same plot, or are they reassigned? How does that work?
Generally speaking, they do choose to keep the same plot, because at some point you develop the soil to your needs in the plot and it becomes kind of perfect for what you're doing. So almost everybody wants to keep the same plot moving forward. But sometimes they do want to try something new, particularly, let's say it's their second season. They're kind of likely to try a different plot if it's available. And with our renewal plot holders, I do give them the chance to move plots as a part of the renewal process, obviously with no additional charge. So that is an option for them if they do want to move. But generally speaking, they prefer to stay in the same plot.
I imagine that staying in the same plot would be a plus for Mark fruit growers, because it seems like when you're growing fruit, berries, etc., typically they need more than that first year to really produce. So I imagine it would be a good incentive to stay in the same place, because your perennials or your, you know, plants that come back every year, that would be an advantage?
That's possible. Oftentimes, I think the community gardens tends more towards annuals, that, you know, people are growing vegetables and that sort of thing, that they're not necessarily planting things that are going to go generational.
Right.
Right. And, you know, Blake can correct me on that if I'm wrong. But for the most part, it's kind of vegetable gardening. I mean, you could do some berries, I would think, you know, certainly within a season, you could have a strawberry plot. That's certainly feasible. And you wouldn't have to worry if you decided not to garden that plot the next year. It's, you know, not a big loss of investment or anything from doing that. So, yeah, so I think they can be mixed and matched a little bit.
And he's about right, too. It is definitely we definitely see more annuals. We do give people the option for perennials, but it's just a communication that I request from them. If they are going to leave something over winter, I just like to know about it so that I'm aware that the plot's not fully clear and there's a good reason for it.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. So they can have the option to do the perennial, but it's more likely you're going to see annuals out
yeah.
there. Okay. What are the rules for maintaining the garden? And I'm guessing like organic is big, because you don't want anything spreading to your, you know, neighbor's garden plot.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Organic gardening is a requirement for the community gardens because, yeah, we just don't want the rules are definitely formed around the central concept of be kind to your neighbor's plots, and anything that could affect your neighbor's plot negatively is something that you want to avoid doing. So that's why we have this kind of stringent request of having people really maintain the weeds in their plot, because otherwise there's the obvious example of, let's say your plot gets overrun with dandelions. Those will spread to the neighboring plots, 100%. Those seeds will spread. So we just ask people to kind of keep that stuff managed so that it doesn't have an effect on the neighboring plots.
I totally get that. Chickweed is my arch nemesis. I hate that stuff. Are there restrictions on what people can grow?
It's kind of in the same line. There are restrictions. The primary rules are height-based. We don't want anything too tall or like bushy growing, because it'll likely cause shade on the neighboring plot. So those are kind of the primary parameters. And then, you know, just kind of more obvious stuff that wouldn't be allowed. But definitely the height is kind of the main one. And then we try to stay away from, obviously people don't usually choose to add these things, but invasive weeds of any kind. But yeah, I don't think people are adding those on purpose.
Yeah, for sure. Are the gardeners who take care of the plots expected to contribute to the overall garden maintenance, or is it just their plot?
They are expected to contribute a little bit. So the request and the guideline is that folks kind of take care of the weeding immediately around their plot in the pathways. Because I would genuinely love to take care of all that, but there are 248 plots and 5 gardens, and I simply don't have the time. So that is kind of the main way that we ask folks to help, is to just maintain the weeds immediately around their plot and the pathways. And in that way, if everyone does that little part, things will be much cleaner.
Sure. Community gardens.
Exactly.
Yeah. And are all of the plots the same size, or does it vary by location?
It varies by location, and they are all by location. They're approximately the same. So many of them at C Street are approximately 10 foot by 20 foot, for example. And that is a pretty common dimension. Some of them are smaller in the 10 by 15 range at some of the other gardens. And then we also have our raised bed plots at Fairview Lions Community Garden, as well as the Chanchnew Community Garden. And those are approximately 3 feet by 8 feet, and they're about 3 feet tall.
And what are the most commonly grown plants that you're seeing when you take a walk in the gardens?
Yeah, there's so many good ones. I've seen a lot of bok choy. I've seen a lot of broccoli. I've seen a fair amount of strawberries, actually, as well. Some garlic is a big request for overwintering. I've had a few requests on that. And so, yeah, those are kind of the big ones that I've seen that people love, because people, they, like I said, they're focusing on kind of food mm-hmm. as much as possible. So those are kind of the most popular ones that I've seen.
And how about the most unusual or interesting?
It's hard to say on a specific unusual plant, but there is one plot that I'd like to reference where someone is actually using these vertical planters at a plot at Chanchnew to kind of maximize their space. And not only are they doing that, but they're using it to grow these tiny flowers that they then – I had a conversation with this gardener, obviously, that they then – they take those flowers, dry them up, and put them in little ornaments. Ooh. And they sell them as crafts for like Christmas and everything. But that's probably the most interesting and unique setup that I've seen.
Interesting. Yeah. So not necessarily for, you know, use throughout winter or, you know, edible plants, but something to make crafts from.
Right. Exactly.
That's really cool. Have you noticed any trends in what people are growing, or is it pretty consistent?
I wish I could give you a better answer on that. This is just kind of my second summer that I'm heading into, but ask me again next year and I'll have a little bit more for you on that one.
Do the community gardens serve a larger purpose beyond just providing garden space? Have you seen anything with like food security, education? Is any of that going on?
Yes, actually. I mean, there's the inherent food security benefit of any gardener who is using the gardens is getting an opportunity to increase their own personal food security in the home, because we're only asking $40 a plot per year. So certainly if you're keeping at it, your harvest will overvalue that amount for sure. So that is definitely something that kind of is an inherent value of community gardens, with the food security, as well as the Chanchnew food forest that is accessible to the public also adds a degree of food security, even for non-plot holders. And as far as education goes, we do use the gardens as an educational space sometimes. For example, last year I had a couple of educators reach out to me, and they work with visually impaired kids a lot. And so they reached out to me to see if there was anything I could do as like a small pop-up class for them. So I had them meet me at the Chanchnew Community Garden, and we did an herb repotting class, because I figured herbs would be perfect for that, because it provides such a strong smell aspect mm-hmm. that would be beneficial to someone with a visual impairment.
Oh, I love that. Have you seen any gardeners collaborating with each other, kind of working together?
Yes, and we do love to see that. There's many situations where gardeners will need or want help from their fellow gardeners. For example, it's summer in Alaska. People want to explore. They want to see the lakes, the rivers, the mountains, whatever it is that does it for them. So there's a lot of people on vacation. So there's a lot of situations where they're asking their neighbors, their garden neighbors, to water their plants for them for a little while. There's also one story I heard of these two real life neighbors that always travel to and from the garden together. And I just thought that was awesome. It's so nice to hear of those collaborative stories.
That is awesome. What advice would you give to someone who's new to gardening but considering applying for a plot?
I would say to get in early. Like I said, it happens when you're not thinking about it. We do our new plot registration in January, February, March. So get in earlier than you think would be my first piece of advice. Another piece of advice is that the Muni does offer some gardening classes. So we have our Green Thumb series, which is actually happening right now. Not right now, but it's open for registration right now. And we still have 5 more classes that people can sign up for. Those are on Tuesday nights from 5:30 to 7:30. And in addition to that, I would say it's always harder at the beginning and the end of the season. Obviously, the maintenance is very important in between those two stages, but just remember, it's not as bad as it feels at the beginning. Obviously, that initial workload is just a bit heavier than the maintenance end of it.
Sure. So if someone was interested in these classes, where are they and how do they find out more information?
Yeah, they can always go to the Muni website, muni.org/parks, and find some more information under the recreation and registration tab would be specifically where they would access the registration for the classes. They take place at one of two locations that are very close together. So they either happen in the Manlizer Memorial Greenhouse, which is right there on Lydia Selcraig Lane off of DeBar between Pine and Boniface. And then also off of Lydia Selcraig Lane, they happen at the Russian Jack Chalet, the Lydia Selcraig Chalet there. And it just depends on the class. It'll tell you when you register which location, but it's one of those two.
And do you happen to know which classes are being offered?
Yes. We did just have How to Kill Your Peony. We brought in a specialist, or how not to kill your peony. I'm so sorry. I constantly make that mistake, but, we had that one. We have a bonsai class at the end of the year. We have a houseplants 101, a houseplants 102. We have a seed starting class. And I hope I'm not missing any there. I think we might have, those are the ones for sure that come to mind.
Those sound great. I think I might just have to sign up for a couple of those.
Yeah, there's still openings in a lot of them.
Okay, awesome.
Most of them are just $15, excluding the bonsai class, because people will actually be leaving with a bonsai. So that one is a little pricier to cover the materials. That one's about $80. Wow. But the rest are just $15. And some of them are more seminar style. Some of them are a little bit more hands-on. It just kind of depends on the class that you sign up for. But it'll tell you more in the description as well, whether it's the hands-on style, the seminar style, the bonsais. The bonsai is obvious because it's just May 6th. It's the only one with bonsai in the name.
Nice. Excellent. Thank you. You're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. I'm host Kim Sherry. After the break, we'll learn more about the Alaska Pioneer Fruit Growers Association with Mark Wolbers.
Alaska Public Media is now partnering with an Alaskan auction service so a helpful local team can get the biggest return for the least hassle should you decide to donate your vehicle. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/vehicle.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Kim Sherry, speaking with Blake Sauer and Mark Wolbers about Anchorage gardening. Hello again, Mark.
Hello.
So with you being the president of the Alaska Pioneers Fruit Growers Association, I'm making the assumption that you are a gardener yourself. Do I have that right?
Okay.
All right. How did you first get into gardening?
I guess it's kind of funny. I don't really think of myself as a gardener. I grow a lot of fruit, but somehow when I think gardener, I think I always think more vegetables for some reason. That's a bias on my part, I guess. But I got into it because moving here to Alaska – I've been here close to 35 years, and when we first came up, apples were really terrible in the grocery stores. I mean, all you could get was a delicious apple that was kind of mealy, hadn't been stored well. And of course, in the last couple of decades, that's changed dramatically. Commercial growers have developed ways to store apples and maintain quality and move them into the stores so that you can get an apple that's been in storage a year, and it's a great apple now. But it wasn't always that case. But besides that, you know, the apples that are commercially available are somewhat monolithic. So it's kind of dominated by variations of Gala or Honeycrisp or Fuji. Those would be the three that kind of vary. And so if you want something different than that, something a little bit more unique, you probably got to grow your own. And so that's for me, having also been raised in Michigan. I grew up with a really great variety of apples that were fresh, and apples fresh off the tree are very special. And cherries and some of the other fruits, blueberries, things like that. So I missed that. That was a kind of a cultural thing that I missed. And of course, we always had like cider mills and things like that in Michigan where you could go get some fresh apple cider made with a variety of apples. And the flavor of that was very different from, let's say, a gallon of Honeycrisp apple cider juice that you might get in the grocery store, which I don't even consider apple cider. So so the great thing about being here in Alaska is that the kind of apples that we can grow, they produce a really beautiful fresh cider juice that's very reminiscent of the cider of my childhood. And so there's a lot of nostalgia for me that's tied in, I guess, to fruit growing and what we do with the fruit. So, yeah. So that's how I got kind of involved with it.
Would it be safe to say that apples are your passion fruit?
Yes and no. I have a fair number of apples. I have a I'm an urban grower. I live here in Anchorage and on the east side, and so I have a 11,000 square foot lot and produce about on an average year. I'll produce about 300 pounds of apples and about 160 pounds or so of cherries, and then a number of gallons of what they call Hascaps or honeyberries and blueberries. Strawberries, raspberries, that sort of thing. So it's a pretty productive space. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of like to, share that with people that, you know, you don't have to have a lot of space and you can actually produce quite a bit, but it does take some time for trees to come into, you know, once you start a tree and to get it up to size to start producing fruits, probably, you know, 3 to 5 years. So, you know, the old adage of, you know, the best time to plant an apple tree was 10 years ago. It's kind of true. Or plant it today and then harvest it going forward. But, yeah, apples are a big part of what we grow. We can grow those fairly successfully here in Alaska. But cherries, too, I think are a great crop. And these Hascaps are what people commonly call honeyberries. They're very easy to grow. And they're really short season, super hardy. So, you know, oftentimes people will say, well, what should I start with? If I just want to have some fruit, well, the easiest thing is probably, you know, 2 Hascap bushes or 2 honeyberry bushes, because they're, you have to have 2 different cultivars that blossom at the same time for pollination, but they're not fussy like blueberries. They don't have any particular soil requirements. You know, blueberries, you know, they have to have an acidic soil of 5.5, blah, 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 you know. So they're kind of the princess berry. But the honeyberries are not. You can just pretty much put them in your yard and they'll do pretty good. You have to net them for birds because the birds love them too.
Okay.
But other than that, they're really pretty carefree.
Okay. I might come back to honeyberries in a little bit here because I'm intrigued. Let's go to the Alaska Pioneer Fruit Growers Association. Tell me what it's all about. How did it get started? And what do you all do?
Yeah. So this organization, we are currently a nonprofit with between 300 and 350 members statewide. And it had its start here in the Anchorage area back in the mid-1980s with some people who were just like wanting to figure out how to grow things like apples and cherries, because those things weren't being grown here in Alaska. In Anchorage, a lot of people know the Lawrence Clark Orchard down, I'm clutching down the name of the road, South Anchorage. But that orchard is one of the historic orchards here in town, and Lawrence Clark actually was one of the people that kind of figured out, you know, some combinations of rootstocks to use and what cultivars would actually ripen within our season length and would survive our winters and that sort of thing. But he and some others, Bob Purvis and some other people that folks might know, you know, they got together to form this club to basically start building that information, that knowledge base, and to be able to share it with people. And so we formally incorporated as a nonprofit, I think in 1995. And so since then, it's just kind of been growing. And so we help. That's our mission, is that we help people learn how to grow fruit successfully, how to take care of it. And we have activities basically all year round that are kind of centered towards this.
Excellent. now that we know a little bit about the association, maybe you could give some of our listeners some gardening and fruit growing advice. What fruits grow the easiest in Alaska?
Well, there's a number that are fairly easy to grow. Most every, you know, anybody has a little bit of property, oftentimes either has inherited or they've started a raspberry patch.
Oh, yes.
All right. So for better or for worse. And you can manage raspberries. They don't have to be a wild, jungly thing that expands and takes over your yard and also your neighbor's yard on the other side of the fence. You can manage raspberries, but you can grow a wide variety of those. And they'll crop usually in the beginning of August. And you can grow red raspberries, grow yellow raspberries, or even purple raspberries. And those are fairly fairly easy to do. Strawberries, like we mentioned before, strawberries are a fairly easy fruit to grow. And I classify things like currants. Mm-hmm. So like I'm a big fan of black currants, but all the currants do quite well here in Alaska, as do gooseberries. And a lot of people aren't really familiar with gooseberries, but they're kind of a large, I want to say a large offshoot of a currant. They form large round fruits, and and some of them are just really fabulous. They make great jams, and actually, I found out lately that they also make a really wonderful wine. So.
But, so what's the flavor like of a gooseberry?
Well, it depends. There's lots of them. They can be kind of tart. They can range anywhere from tart to sweet. And so there's lots of variety, just like in currants. There's everything from red, white, pink to black currants. My favorite is black currants. And so I grow black currants, and I use them mainly for winemaking. Because they are, if you're in a place that you can't grow grapes, they're a wonderful substitute for that.
So. Interesting. Any classes on winemaking out there?
Well, that's one of the things that our club, you know, talks about from time to time. We had a guest on one of our winter lecture series who was a major cider maker from Oregon. And he gave a presentation on, you know, making your own hard cider. And looking at our apple profiles up here, you know, we can make some really great both fresh and hard ciders here. So
interesting. All right. Are there certain regions of Alaska better for growing different fruits? Like, I'm guessing interior differs from Anchorage.
What we tell people is that every yard is a microclimate. In other words, even here in Anchorage, what happens climate-wise over by the airport is very different than what happens climate-wise farther inland or up the side of the mountain. And so it depends, you know, like my yard is different from my neighbor's yard in that I have a south-facing slope that I have my orchard on. And so it captures sunlight much more efficiently. Soil warms better. You know, it's the first place that snow melts off when we have spring comes. And so that's a microclimate. Mm-hmm. You couldn't look at East Anchorage and go, well, that's what your climate is. No, my climate's actually somewhat different from my neighbor's climate. We really encourage everybody to kind of study, if you will, what it is you're trying to, where you are and what your season's like. Now, on a science way side of this, I'm trying to encourage people to invest in what they call temperature loggers. And these are devices that make a record of what your temperature is every 10, 20, or 30 minutes. And with that information, you can run it through a program. You can find out how many growing degree days you're actually having occur in your space. Hmm. And these heat units are what determine when things happen for the plants. When they bloom, you can predict that based on the number of heat units, the number of growing degree days. And you can also pest emergence or even when the fruit comes ripe. And so with that data, if you have that, you can know what varieties you can successfully crop and grow. And so oftentimes, you know, we kind of encourage people to, as they come into the club, hook up with, you know, knowledgeable members who can kind of look at their situation of where they are, and they can maybe make a good guess. You know, yeah, you could grow this kind of cultivar of apple here and expect to have it come ripe. Last year, I laughed because, you know, Costco always brings up a lot of apple trees, right? Mm-hmm. And so I go into Costco and I see all these apple trees, and I ask to speak to one of the managers, and I, you know, the conversation goes kind of like this: boy, you did a great job of picking varieties of apples that will survive here in Alaska, because mm-hmm. they were all like, you know, zone three apples. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, nobody will get a ripe apple off of these trees.
Oh, no.
Because the cultivars, like Honeycrisp, that takes a lot more heat units than what anybody has here in Alaska. You know, so having that kind of knowledge, that's where the club really pays off, right? Because before I was in the club, that's what I did. You know, I wanted an apple tree. I bought one at a local nursery. Yeah, that apple really didn't quite get ripe ever within the summer. I didn't know that. And So anyway, we have very unique growing circumstances here.
That's really interesting to know. Yeah, the hardiness might be right, but your temperature might be totally off.
Yeah, you just might not have the, you know, the amount of heat to get that apple to ripe before winter comes.
Interesting. That's so interesting. So are there any fruits that we are able to grow but maybe take a lot of extra care but are kind of like surprising you in ways?
No, I can't really say that. I mean, I think for the most part, all the fruits will take whatever care you're willing to put into them. Mm-hmm. Like I said, raspberries, you can plant them, walk away from them. They'll fruit. You don't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. If you do go in and manage them, you might be able to get more fruit from them from that given space, right? So you might be able to improve the quality of the berry and the amount of berry by mm-hmm. by managing it. But it's kind of a question of how much do you want to put into it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I say the same thing about, you know, trees. You know, people plant apple trees and things like that. You know, you can plant an apple tree and kind of walk away from it, and it will do its thing. It will flower and fruit and whatnot. But if you're willing to come in and prune it and learn how to prune it and kind of take care of it, it's going to crop better. If you're willing to thin the apples when they're done flowering, you'll get bigger apples, right? And if you manage the crop load appropriately on the tree, then you have a better chance that the next year you'll get a return bloom and a return crop. The tree won't take a year off because apples like to be kind of what we call biennial, where they bear, their natural tendency is to bear really heavily one year and then not do very much the next year. Mm-hmm. And they have this on and off kind of thing. But if you're willing to manage it, right, you can have crops pretty predictably every year if weather cooperates.
I thought I remember reading on your website that you guys do some work with the cooperative extension. Does that have to do with anything with like experimental fruits up here or anything like that?
No, our friends with the cooperative extension, we kind of, our interactions with them are oftentimes about pests.
Oh. Okay.
Because they have actually an entomologist on their staff. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if someone's got a bug infection, you know, infestation, they don't know what it is, or they want suggestions about how to deal with it, or they want some advice about integrated pest management for what they're growing. Then that resource is available through the Extension Service, and we take care of that. We have a number of Extension people are actually members of our organization, and we're very supportive of them. So we constantly try to encourage people to encourage their representatives and whatnot in state government to fund the university, fund that Extension Service, because the any state that has a viable agricultural sector has a viable and robust university extension service, helping to do the research and the development to find out, to help people grow things that suit our environment. And like I said, Alaska is a very unique growing environment. You really can't take things in other places from the United States and mm-hmm. plug and play here. It just doesn't work that way. So,
yep. Have you noticed any effects of any climate change on fruit growing in Alaska? Are you seeing anything happen?
Oh, yes. Mm. Yeah. Climate change has been has had some, well, the last three seasons, we've been very negatively affected by climate change. Mm-hmm. So what's happening is that here in South Central Alaska, the last three seasons, we have been pushed into a real, what we would call a maritime climate, mm-hmm. where the summer is overcast constantly, there's rain constantly. And when you have overcast, of course, you're not getting sun, which means you're not generating heat. So what we were talking about earlier about, you know, plants needing a certain number of heat units to get ripe, you know, a couple of these summers, especially this last summer was okay. The summer before, a lot of things just didn't develop the sugars or have enough heat units to really ripen. And of course, the rain is very problematic if you're trying to grow cherries. It tends to cause mold issues with fruits and things like that. Mm-hmm. And cherries will crack under rain pressure. Mm-hmm. The climate change thing is not positive. So, you know, the gardeners, you know, will point to things like, well, you know, the frost-free date has kind of moved back. And this is true. But what's happening with climate change is that you're not getting uniform warming, what you're getting is more extreme potential for weather events. Mm. So even though our overall climate might be warming, it's not as predictable. And the thing that a grower really wants is predictability, mm-hmm. right? They want to know, well, when is that last frost date for sure, mm-hmm. right? Because we've seen like in the lower 48, like New York, a year or two ago, they all lost like their entire apple crop because late spring cold snap came down. And here in Alaska, it's no different, right? Sometimes our season will go into October, but if we get a clear high pressure system in September, we can effectively be done middle of September, where nighttime temperatures will go down to 20 degrees. Just through radiation, and then season is over. So I'd say, yeah, it's not. I would much better have predictability than a really erratic weather.
Yeah, for sure. So my next question was going to be, you know, due to climate change, are there any fruits that we could be growing here that maybe we couldn't earlier? But it sounds like just the unpredictability doesn't even allow us to explore that.
Well, yes and no. What I tell people is that if I were a younger person, I would have been structuring my fruit growing around inside, around undercover, under high tunnel, mm. or in a greenhouse, because then I can control for rain. I can increase my season length, and I'm not at the whims of Mother Nature. And so I could grow much more predictably. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's real potential for that in Alaska. I mean, that if you have a high tunnel or you have a greenhouse, it's been shown here in Alaska that you can grow some pretty extraordinary things.
Examples.
Well, an example would be the Boyer's greenhouse in Anchorage, where if you walk into their greenhouse, you'll find everything from late season apples that would require way too long a growing season to grow outside, to fruits like, you know, peaches and plums and of course Bell's, you know, just growing wine grapes, right, in a greenhouse, right, mm-hmm. and making his own wine. Mm-hmm. So that you know, having that kind of structure, I think, would be if you wanted to have that kind of agriculture and be able to do it predictably, you would have to do it undercover.
So, Mark, you are a wealth of information, and I kind of want to bring you into my garden and give me advice. But for those of us that can't do that, does the association offer classes or resources for people who just need to know more?
Yeah, our website is open. It's not restricted. The website is the initials of our organization, which is Alaska Pioneer Fruit Growers Association. So it's APFGA.org. And you can go on there. We have a tab that's called Meeting Slides and Videos, where all of our guest speakers during our winter speaker series, we record all those. Those things are up there. I have one up there about establishing an apple orchard. It's basically just a recounting of all the errors that I made in doing mine and how I'd recommend that people kind of progress if they're going to do theirs. And then we have activities all through the year. So first things we do in the spring is actually we hold pruning workshops, and we do one in Boyer's greenhouse. And then I think next week I'll be up in the valley at Mid Valley Greenhouse. We'll do a little pruning demonstration there. And then we have our grafting workshop, which is actually open to the public. That's on April 12th. It'll be at Bagage Middle School between 1 to 2:30, and the public's invited to come in. Every year we import about 2,000 rootstocks, cherry and apple and some other things, rootstocks. And we do have some of that that we make available for the public to purchase. And we have the scion wood, which is last year's growth from the fruit trees that people have collected. And that's what you use to graft onto the rootstock to now produce the tree that you want to have. So let's say you want to grow a Prairie Magic apple. You come to the grafting workshop, we'll have Prairie Magic scion wood. And then there'll be somebody there that can help show you how you like put these two things together and grow your own Prairie Magic apple tree. So, and then after that, we do some top working workshops, which is where you take an existing tree and you add something to it. You can add a different apple to an apple tree. You know, if you have a crab apple and you want an edible apple, you can graft that onto there. So you can kind of make Frankenstein trees if you want. We've been doing this demonstration actually over at Airport Heights Elementary on some of their cherry trees that are in front of their parking lot. They have some Prunus macchi ornamental trees, and you can graft different cherries onto those. And so we show people kind of grafting techniques for top working. Then the summertime, we'll have orchard tours. We'll have usually three orchard tours where you go out, you can see examples of people who are successfully doing this and ask questions about how they set things up and whatnot. And then as we move into fall, we have apple pressing events where our members can bring apples from their trees and we'll help them grind them and press them for apple cider. And after that, we have what we call fruit tasting events. Mm-hmm. We have one here in Anchorage and one in the valley. And so you can come in and sample all the different apples and things that are growing here locally. And we tell people that's always a great place to start because you find out what you like. And hopefully you can ask the person who grew that fruit, like where they live, and kind of see if there's a comparison to where you live. Like maybe would that apple do well in my spot? And then you write that down, you keep that information, and then when spring comes, you go to the grafting workshop, and now you know what apples you want to graft or whatnot, because you figured out which ones you like and things like that. Because none of the apples that we grow up here are what I would call common name apples. You'd have to be a real apple aficionado to recognize any of the varieties that we're growing here. So.
You guys offer a lot of help, and I think I'm going to sign up for some of these because I would love to know more about growing apples. I actually only thought originally that we only have crab apples here. Oh. So this has been kind of mind-blowing for me. I might be asking your advice here pretty soon, okay. Mark. Well, I want to thank both of you, Blake and Mark, for being here today. I have learned so much, and it sounds like there's a bunch of classes that I need to sign up for now. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Of course. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for joining us today for Hometown Alaska. And thanks to our guests, Blake Sauer and Mark Wolbers. Ammon Swenson produces this show. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org, the Alaska Public Media app, or wherever you get your podcast. I'm Kim Sherry. Thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.